Episode 2147, My Strength is My Story with Kayla Steckline, Fear Gone Wild.
Moms, needing a little inspiration and a ray of hope? You've come to the right place. This is the show that you can turn to for just the pick-me-up you need. This is Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. Here's your host, certified life coach, personal trainer, and nutritionist, Christiane Wargo. Staring at
a stop sign. Happy every day. Today is my favorite day of the week. It is my Strength is My Story series, and we have with us Kayla Steckline. Her story is riveting. She is going to draw you in, and she is such a lovely, strong woman. I don't want to give any of her story away, but I've got to tell you, during this holiday season, it is so important that you listen, especially for those who you love so much. For those of you who are brand new to Create You Now, friends and family of Kayla's, welcome to our family. I'm so delighted of your presence. If you already had the opportunity, you'll want to head on over to createyournow.com, where you can learn more and sign up for the Kisses newsletter, the Keep It Simple Strategy, Everyday Solutions to Live, Love, and Impact. This episode is brought to you by the AIM Academy. You know, Kayla's story has so much wrapped up in it. If you're a person of faith, you need to listen. If you're a person who needs more hope, you need to listen. If you know that there's joy in your everyday, you need to listen. Because we need to begin to see the beauty in everything. Be in awe of where you are right now. Be grateful. See the blessings that God has placed within your life. And also the hardships. It's all about rebuilding beautiful. Without further ado, let's welcome in Kayla Steckline, Fear Gone Wild.
Hello and welcome to Create You Now. I am so excited. We have an extraordinary woman in our presence today here on My Strength is My Story series, Kayla Steckline. She is an incredible mom of three beautiful boys, ages 4, 6, and 7. And she's also a widow with the loss of her husband, Andrew, who died by suicide. She has written her first book, Fear Gone Wild, a story of mental illness, suicide, and hope through loss. Welcome, my friend and sister in Christ. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm excited to have you here. Your presence says everything. And so first off, I just have to say thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for you being so gracious, taking the time to share your intimate story between you and Andrew. And then I have another thought really for our listeners today. You're going to hear this story and it's going to resonate with you. And I want you to be open to what you hear. You're going to have people that are going to pop into your mind. I want you to be mindful of that. And I want you to also be prayerful of that. You might be a lifeline for someone today. And so, Kayla, with that, I've got to ask you, what brings you joy?
My boys. Yeah, my three boys, you know, they're just living, breathing joy in my home every day.
I can imagine. I mean, that age is awesome. I, too, have three boys, and they're not all grouped together within three of the five, so mine are spread out a little bit more, but they are so rambunctious. What do you love most right now about your seven-year-old?
Oh, he's so fun. You know, he's getting so big. He's getting so tall and he's changing. I mean, it's crazy to watch the way that even like our relationship is changing as he gets older and matures and like doesn't love the hugs and kisses from mom as much as he used to. But I love just like playing with him, playing football with him, jumping on the trampoline with him. He's into backflips right now. So watching him do those things. And really what we've been doing a lot lately is surfing together, which has been super fun.
Wow. Well, I knew you paddleboard, but surfing. Oh, how awesome.
Yeah, super fun.
Oh, that's great. And what about your other two? Because you've got your baby. I believe his name is Brave.
Brave. Yeah, he's 4. Yeah, you know, and he's the one that loves to cuddle and snuggle. And so I get that love. Lots and lots of love from him. When I put him to bed at night, he asks for like 5 kisses and 5 hugs, and it's so cute. But yeah, you know, They're all kind of into the same sorts of things. My middle son is really into the outdoors. So he loves like guns and bows and arrows. And so he's got a whole like stash of Nerf guns and cap guns and loves to watch like the hunting shows. And my four-year-old loves like trucks and cars and Mickey. And so they all still like the same things, but I guess they still have their own little things too. But, you know, we play a lot outside. We're at the beach a ton. We're actually in the process of moving in a couple weeks to the beach, live closer to the ocean. It's been such a healing part of our journey, just being near the ocean. And we go down to the beach like an hour from here. And we go down probably two or three times a week. So we're excited to live there. And we just love to be outside and be doing fun stuff together.
Well, and it just allows you to take in God's masterpiece, nature. I mean, how can you not love and look around and see from trees to sand to waves to feeling the wind on your face? It truly brings life to real life. And with that, Kayla, I want to start with your love story, because of course I've got the ins and outs of Fear Gone Wild, but our listeners don't yet. And so I know this started in a beautiful space. Can you start with that discovery there?
Yeah, so my husband, Andrew, and I, we met at a little Christian college called Vanguard University in Costa Mesa, California. And I was a sophomore and he was a junior, and his best friend was dating my best friend. And so one day she was over at the beach house that he lived at, and she showed him a picture of all of her friends, and he picked me out of the picture. And so she's like, this guy wants to meet you. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so scary. Like, he lives at this beach house with all these other guys. Like, it's super intimidating. And so I made a friend come with me. And we showed up to the beach house. And like right away, I was just super attracted to him. He was just different. You know, he had a really good head on his shoulders and was really mature for a 19-year-old guy, and he just really knew what he wanted to do with his life, and he was already headed in that direction, and that was super attractive to me. And so we went on a date and then another date, and by like the third date we're kissing in the rain after a Coldplay concert, and we just fell in love really fast. He asked me to marry him a year later, and then we got married in December 2010.
Wow. So you guys were married a total of nine years?
Almost 8 years.
Yeah. Almost 8 years. Okay. But you'd been together though
for 10.
So that's still a lot of life, a whole decade to live and to love someone. You got married, you moved on. He was offered a pastor position, I believe, away from California, if I remember correctly. But then you were called back home to your home church, the church that was started by Andrew's dad, Dave. Shortly after that, the family was given some unexpected news.
Yeah, you know, we had our little time away, and we thought we were going to be in Seattle longer than we were, but we felt drawn back home, and my husband was offered this job, and right away we just saw that it was all God's timing, because, yeah, just a few months after we moved back, his dad was diagnosed with leukemia. And so Andrew, you know, the role that he had been given at the church was the creative arts director, and he ended up really never doing that role because his dad got sick and he kind of just stepped up to the plate and was helping him basically co-lead the church. He was helping lead staff meetings. He was speaking regularly on Sundays. We have pictures of him and his dad in the hospital room at Cedar Sinai in LA with their laptops open, planning messages, booking guest speakers, like running a church from a little hospital room. And that's kind of what our life was like for 4 years. You know, he battled leukemia for 4 years, and it was remission and relapse, remission and relapse. And his dad was just like him, like super driven, loved the local church. And so he was speaking through all of that time. He would show up on Sunday and still speak, and even though he was battling cancer. But there were Sundays too where his dad was scheduled to speak, and, you know, Saturday night he's being rushed to the hospital and they're calling Andrew like, hey, you gotta give the message tomorrow. And so he'd have to come up with a message that night to give the next day. So it was a really exhausting and just emotional and painful 4 year journey with his dad. And just before his dad passed away in May of 2015, we had this really special service. where his mom and dad and the board and I got to come on stage, and his dad handed him a baton, like an actual baton that was engraved with the church and the date, and he basically handed him the leadership of the church. And just 3 months later, maybe a little more than 3 months later, it was October of 2015, he passed away.
Wow. That had to have been hard, really hard on Andrew.
It was. You know, his dad was his best friend. He was his mentor. He looked up to him so much, and he thought when he accepted that role at the church, you know, he imagined doing ministry with his dad for years. He imagined that eventually, maybe one day he would take over the church, but maybe like 10, 15, 20 years down the road, you know, we never thought that just 4 years later, less than 4 years later, that his dad would be gone and that he would be the lead pastor. So it was really deeply painful. And, you know, Andrew's heart was for the local church. He loved the church so much, just like his dad. And so he never really took time off to grieve. He took like 2 weeks off and then came right back and gave a message series on heaven. His heart was to lead the church through their grief, and he kind of put his own grief on the back burner. So it was, you know, I think it was a pain that he never fully processed.
Mm. And, you know, we all deal with pain differently. When he was thrown into this position quite quickly, I mean, he was just young. What was he, 23, 26, that he was a lead pastor?
Yeah, he became the lead pastor at 26.
Yeah, I mean, and we're not talking of a congregation of 50 to 100 people here. Where, you know, and that's an average sized church. We're talking about a much bigger, thousands of people that are relying on him. How did that affect you all, both good and bad?
Yeah, you know, it was a really exciting time, as painful as it was. You know, he was really excited and really honored, and the church was excited and had open arms welcoming him into the position. You know, he had kind of proven himself over those years with the leukemia journey, and so it was a really easy transition. You know, I didn't grow up in a pastor's family. I grew up attending church, but I didn't grow up in a pastor's family, and there's just so much that happens behind the scenes in ministry that I think I didn't really think about, you know, becoming a pastor's wife and kind of marrying into this. Like, there's just so much, and it's hard. It's a really hard position. There's, especially now in the age of social media, there's just so much pressure on pastors to be everything, to be the charismatic, funny, energetic, extroverted leader, and then also to be this visionary that's like also business minded and like leading this organization. You know, our church was large. The staff was probably about 35 people. And so it's a lot of, you're putting a lot of pressure on a person that's a human being. You know, they can only do so much. And so, you know, I watched as that pressure, my husband took on that pressure, and it was a lot. And behind the scenes, it was a lot. And carrying that with him and trying to serve him the best that I could, it was a lot. And there's a huge learning curve, I think, to all of it. And I think eventually pastors find their groove and they find what works for them and build the team around them that best supports them. But yeah, you know, it can be lonely at the top. It can be hard to have people that you can trust and to have people that are in your inner circle, that are your close friends, that you can be real and honest with, because the majority of your friends are either on staff or attend the church. And so it's just a really difficult position to be in, but it's also such a huge honor and just an amazing blessing to lead a church like that and to be the person that's called to lead that. And so it was all of it. You know, it was a huge honor. I loved being a pastor's wife. I loved sitting in the front row and like, that's my husband on stage giving the message. Like, I'm the wife he's talking about in his message. Like, I get to do this amazing thing with him. Like, it was so much bigger than us, and we really felt called to serve it together. And, you know, I found so much of my purpose and my calling in his calling. His purpose became my purpose. His calling became my calling. And I found my unique areas and ministry to serve. But it was hard. It was hard. You know, it wasn't all easy. Leading a church is hard. Leading any kind of organization, I think, is hard.
Most definitely, yes. And I can relate. My father was a pastor. And so I do know what goes on behind the scenes, and so many people do not. It is different. There are so many stories you and I could share, but I do think it's important because we're talking about something seriously here. All about your book, Fear Gone Wild. You all are going to want to pick up your own copy of A Story of Mental Illness, Suicide, and Hope Through Loss. Kayla, at one point, Andrew began experiencing panic attacks. Take us down that road, because this was after he became a lead pastor at his church.
Yeah, it was the fall of 2017. Our family had experienced this like stalker issue, and I think that was the biggest invitation for fear for him. He was taking on so much responsibility, not only for the church, but for also for our family. And so he'd become the leader of the family in a lot of ways, just like his dad was. And so it was a lot of responsibility for him. And then this fear with this stalker issue really created just this sense of fear, I think, in his mind and in his body. And so he started experiencing these panic attacks about 3 to 4 times a week. And they would mostly come on when he would try to fall asleep in clinic. And he'd be up for hours, you know, pacing around the house, curled up in the fetal position on the floor, trembling, shaking, doing anything he could do to try to wait it out and get them to go away. And really, there was nothing I could do to help him. It was really terrifying, and for him and for me, you know, it would take over his whole body. As he would describe it to me as this really intense pain in his chest. And then eventually, like, his hands and his feet would go numb and his whole body would be trembling and he couldn't control it. And so it was really scary. And so we were seeing doctors trying to figure out, like, where are these coming from? What's going on? Does he have, like, a health condition? We had thought it was a thyroid thing. And so we were doing all these blood work and seeing doctors and trying to figure out, why is he having these? Where are they coming from? And why aren't they going away? And so it took months. And all the tests were coming back like normal. Like, there was nothing that they were finding on any of the tests that was abnormal. And so he was still having panic attacks. He ended up having a massive panic attack that landed him in the hospital. And it was then that we all decided, like, enough is enough. We don't know what's causing these. We don't know where they're coming from. We don't know why they're not going away. But we know that he can't function like this anymore, and we can't function like this anymore. And so we need to, like, take a break and reevaluate and get him some rest and get him some more help and try to figure out, kind of get to the bottom of why these are happening and just try to get him healthy. You know, like, he can only function like that for so long. And he was still speaking and leading the church through all of that. There was Sundays where he would have a massive panic attack right before he was supposed to go on stage, and he would go on stage anyway and preach. So we put him on this sabbatical, and then it was there that we started this mental health journey.
Wow. Well, in that, you talk about statistics with pastors and mental illness. What have you learned from your journey going through it with Andrew and even to this day?
Yeah, you know, he had a favorite book. It's called Leading on Empty by Wayne Cordero. It was a book that he read over and over and over. He was reading it during his sabbatical. He was telling everybody he knew to read it. Unfortunately, I didn't get to read it until after he passed away because I was just so busy with the boys and with caring for him during that time. But in the book, he shares these statistics, and it is, like, really startling, and it does, I think, hit home for a lot of pastors. Some of those statistics include things like 50% of pastors feel unable to meet the needs of the job, 90% feel inadequately trained to deal with ministry demands, 70% of pastors do not have someone they consider a close friend, and 45.5% of pastors say they have experienced depression or burnout to the extent that they needed to take a leave of absence from ministry. So Andrew fell into those statistics, and he did burn out. You know, I think the burnout was a combination of being so young, of being thrust into such a big position in a very young age, of losing his father, of having 3 little boys back to back to back in a busy home life. Like, he couldn't come home and necessarily rest. It's like you switch. It's the second shift. You go from working and then you come home and you're parent and you got to play and make dinner and get kids to bed. And by the time you lay down, you're just completely exhausted. Then you get up and do it all over again. And so, you know, I think he did burn out. I think he burned out, and I think the burnout probably started with those panic attacks, and it just took us time to realize that's what that was.
And he was actually diagnosed with depression.
He was, yeah. So a few weeks into the sabbatical, we made an appointment with a psychiatrist and went in to see him. And, you know, I left the room and he did all these questions with him, evaluation. And I came back in the room and the psychiatrist looked at me and said, "Your husband has depression." And I was really shocked. Andrew was this like resilient, driven, could rise to the occasion every time, Mr. Fix-It, could figure anything out. So I just, you know, I really never thought something like that could happen to him. I really never saw it coming. And for Andrew, he was relieved. He was relieved to have a diagnosis. He was relieved to finally know what was going on inside of his body and what was causing the panic attacks. And, you know, the doctors were really confident that he was on the low end of the spectrum and with rest and time off work and the right medication and therapy, like he would bounce right back and that he would be back to work, off medication, doing better, healthy in no time. And so that reassured me and that reassured him as well. And so we were confident, you know, we were in the right care and that we would take the right next steps and that he would be okay.
Well, in all of this, and I'm sure coming out now on the other side, even though it's still a journey yet to be written, what have you discovered and how can we support our leaders in ministry, not just our pastors, but all of our leaders in ministry?
Yeah, I think checking in on them, like seeing them not only as a leader and a pastor, but also as a human, like they're a real human being. They're not superhuman. They're human and they have real human emotions. And so I think even asking like, how are you? How are you holding up? Like so often people in ministry are caring for others and they're pouring out and aren't getting filled up as much. And so I think, you know, seeing them as human, expecting them not to be perfect, like no one's perfect. Save those nasty emails for yourself or for your therapist. Like, let's not send those in. Don't complain about little tiny things like what the worship leader is wearing on stage on Sunday. Like, it's crazy some of the stuff that comes in that people nitpick and, you know, care enough about to write an email about. But I think just, gosh, having so much grace for people in ministry and having so much grace for the leadership and knowing that they're not going to get it right all of the time. And that they're not God, you know, they're not Jesus, like they're human. And so I think checking in on them and caring for them. And when they do mess up, when they do make a mistake, like instead of criticizing or judging, like checking in on them and emailing them and calling them and seeing if they're okay. Yeah, I think there's just so much pressure on people in ministry to be perfect, and they'll never be because we're human and all of us are not perfect.
For sure, and we're striving to be like Jesus, but there's no way we can ever be like him until he calls us home. We have to remember that, and I do think that we tend to put our pastors especially, but our ministry leaders on this tippy top ladder. And oh my gosh, if they make one wrong move, they are falling and they fall hard and fast. Kayla, we've talked a lot about pastors. We've talked a lot about Andrew. How did you handle this as a spouse walking alongside someone who was going and dealing with mental illness?
It was really hard. It was a really difficult summer. And I was so torn between being caretaker for my husband and then mom for my three kids, who were 2, 4, and 5 at the time. So really young, rambunctious boys. So our home wasn't the most restful, peaceful, relaxing environment for him to get better, you know. So a lot of the time he was in our bedroom resting and I was back in the living room and outside with the kids. And we kind of just let him do his own thing for his health. And I kind of took on the responsibility of the boys. And I, you know, in a lot of ways, I felt like a single parent. I felt like I was doing everything on my own. And it was exhausting because after I got everybody to bed, then I have this husband who's also not well. And so trying to care for him as well. And it felt very isolating because he was a pastor and because a lot of my close friends attended our church. I didn't feel like I could be completely honest with what was going on inside of our home and how he was really doing and how I was really feeling, because I didn't want them to look down on him. I didn't want them to lose respect for him. I didn't want them to feel like he was incapable of doing his job. And so I, you know, I isolated too. You know, my husband was isolated in our home, in our bedroom, and didn't spend a lot of time with friends or family. And, you know, I was isolated too, kind of to the rest of the house with my three boys. And it just was a really hard season. And my biggest regret is not letting more people in, is not inviting other people into our pain, inviting other people into my husband's pain, inviting other people into my pain. I wish that I would have been brave enough to be honest with how I was really doing. I wish that I would have gone to therapy by myself, not just with my husband. You know, there's so many things I wish I would have done to practice better self-care in that season. And I think self-care is the first thing to go out the window in times like that. But when you're walking alongside somebody with mental illness, it's so important to care for yourself, because you can't keep pouring out from an empty place. And so I wish I would have made more time and created more margin to fill myself back up and to go spend time alone and to hire the babysitter, even though my husband's there resting. Like, I wish I just would have been a little wiser in that. And I think I was just isolated and kind of co-burdening his depression as well. Like, I got a little taste of what he was walking through because I was so close to it.
It's so hard because mental illness is so complicated and it's so taboo. We don't want to talk about it, let alone mention the word suicide. Your husband came back from sabbatical. He was preaching a series called Hot Mess. And it came to the third presentation for, you know, hey, I'm going to get up there, I'm giving it my all. But Thursday came before that Sunday service. What happened?
Yeah, you know, we kind of just had this episode. His mind was still broken. He wasn't fully healed. He told our family and told our staff when he returned to work, he was at about 65%. He wasn't at 100%. And so he wanted to ease back into ministry. He wasn't fully well, but he was ready to go back to work. And him and the doctors were confident that he would be fine, and they released him to go back to work. And so he wanted to ease back in. He said that phrase, ease back in, so many times. He wasn't ready to take on the full responsibility of the position, but he was hoping to over time slowly ease back into that role. And so, yeah, just a really awful day, and his mind was still broken, and so he wasn't able to process what had happened that day like he normally would, you know, as a leader. And so for our family, it was just this big red flag of like, whoa, 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 like maybe he's not even at 65%. Like, maybe he's not as well as we thought he was. Maybe he shouldn't have gone back to work. Maybe he wasn't ready. And so while we were away from him on Friday morning, making arrangements for Sunday, scheduling a guest speaker, trying to take care of everything for him so he wouldn't have to do it himself, we were scheduling a guest speaker for Sunday. We were calling different pastors, trying to figure out if maybe there was a good inpatient option for Andrew. Maybe there was an inpatient place he could go and get more healing. And we hadn't tried that yet. And so we were looking at trying that. And so while we were on the phone with people making arrangements, he attempted suicide. And it was absolutely shocking. That Thursday, we realized that he wasn't good, but we didn't know it was that bad. Like, we had no idea that it was that bad. And even the doctors and the team that was surrounding him during his mental health journey, like, they were absolutely shocked and stunned. We really, truly never saw it coming. And so he was rushed to the hospital. They ran a bunch of tests, and there was nothing that they could do. And so on August 25th, 2018, he passed away.
Wow. The life that you knew, that you loved so much, now gone. But now you sit here and you call it rebuilding beautiful. Kayla, how do you do that? I read your book. It tore me inside out multiple times. Even now, it brings me to tears. How do you get up and fight every day?
It's exhausting. Mm-hmm. and it is that daily choice. I actually don't have a choice because I have three little boys that need their mom. I don't have the luxury of just being a single person that can lay in my bed all day. Like, I have to get out of bed. I have three boys that need breakfast to be made, need help getting ready for school, need lunches to be packed, need to be dropped off at school, need to be picked up from school. Need, you know, they need to be cared for. They can't care for themselves. And so I've had to, since that very first, you know, month, step up to the plate and be like, okay, like, how am I have a choice. I can let this ruin my life, or I can choose to allow God to use this to help other people's lives. And so I chose the latter. You know, I chose to believe that God could squeeze every ounce of good that he possibly could out of something so horrific and traumatic. And I saw right away that he was doing that. Just 3 days after my husband passed away, I wrote him this letter. And that letter kind of went viral. And it was through that letter that I received hundreds of other letters of people's stories, of people sharing how that one letter had such a deep impact on them, of people that were contemplating suicide, that checked themselves into rehab, people that were walking alongside somebody with depression that finally called the doctor and told them how bad it was, people that were struggling with suicidal thoughts that decided to stay. So there was so many powerful stories that came through one letter that I saw right away, like, wow, this is so much bigger than me. This is so much bigger than Andrew. There's so much purpose here, even in the depths of my pain. There's so much purpose here, and God can and is already, just 3 days after he passed away, using this really horrific thing for good. And so who am I to get in the way of him doing that? And so it's a daily choice. It's a daily choice to surrender. It's a daily choice to get out of bed. It's a daily choice to step towards the pain and embrace the pain and to embrace this new life that God's given me. And it is a choice to believe that beauty is still possible, to believe that I can, even though I have this pain that I will carry with me for the rest of my life. The pain of Andrew's death will never go away. I will carry it with me for the rest of my life, but I can choose to build a beautiful life around it. And so that's where that rebuilding beautiful phrase kind of came from for me. It's been this mantra for me in this season of, like, I had this beautiful life. I had everything I could have asked for and more. And that whole beautiful life died with my husband. And I was handed this new life. But I really, truly believe that this new life can be beautiful too.
Amen. Oh, I love your heart, Kayla. And I have to say it this way, the Trinity, three days after you wrote the letter, can't say that there's connections. You have three boys. What a beautiful story. You are rebuilding beautiful. How, though, can we serve our brothers and sisters, the strangers that we may come in contact with, that we say hi and you can just tell something's not right? How can we serve them when we have so many people that are hurting? Where do we start?
You know, I think there's this phrase that I shared in the book that my mother-in-law shared as well. We actually ended up giving my husband's last message months after he passed away. We got on stage. He had already written it, and so we got on stage and gave it. It was really powerful. And she shared this phrase in the message, and the phrase was, "I have no idea." And I think that's really stuck with me and been an important phrase for me. Just, I have no idea. I have no idea what it's like to walk in anybody else's shoes but my own. And so I think when we come across somebody that's in pain, acknowledging that I have no idea what they're wrestling with. I have no idea what it's like to be them. I have no idea about their mental illness or their pain or their grief or what they've walked through. I have no idea what it's like to be them. But, and I think from that posture of, I have no idea, we can lean in and we can ask questions and we can try to catch a glimpse of what life is like from their point of view. And I think by leaning in, instead of criticizing, instead of casting judgment, instead of looking down on somebody or assuming things, it's leaning in and really trying to sit right beside them. You know, I think that's what Jesus would do. You know, it's what he did do. It's what we see throughout scripture. Like, he just sits right beside people that are in pain, and he tries for a minute to catch a glimpse of what life is like from their point of view. And so I think when we do that with somebody that's hurting, when we don't come with all the right answers, when we're not thinking about what we're going to say next, and we're really truly present and actively listening to somebody that's in pain, sometimes our presence is enough. Sometimes all they need is somebody just to sit next to them and listen to them and care for them. And like, really genuinely, you can tell in a conversation with somebody if they genuinely care or not, if they're asking questions just to be polite or if they're asking questions because they genuinely care. So I think doing our best to sit in that posture with the other people that are struggling and to try our best to actively listen and genuinely care. And when we genuinely care, that's practicing real empathy. You know, empathy is an action word. And when real empathy is practiced, the pain is lifted and shared. And, you know, that's biblical. That's community. It's like bearing in each other's burden, sharing in each other's pain. Like, that's what we're called to do.
You know, it's interesting. You titled your book, Fear Gone Wild. And sometimes our own fears of, oh my gosh, I don't know how to help this person, I don't know what to do, holds us back from exactly what we need to do. Just sitting, just listening. We are so bombarded with social media and, you know, stuff. There's just noise all the time that we don't listen to our own people and within our own four walls. And oh my gosh, you said it beautiful. I have no idea. It gives you that posture and that space to say, okay, how can I be there for this person? How can I sit there and serve? So gorgeous. You know, in writing your book, you mentioned that you wrote letters to Andrew. And you shared with them. We can't share it all because they've all got to pick up their own copy of Fear Gone Wild. But if you were to write Andrew today, what would you share with him?
Goodness, 2020 has been a year. There's so many things, you know, that I would love to pick up the phone and talk to him, that I'd love to write him a letter about. But I think, you know, I'd want to tell him first and foremost about his kids, about the boys and who they are. And that's the hardest part, really. You know, I'm getting emotional, but that's the hardest part of moving forward without him, is seeing the boys grow up without their dad. And so I would just want him to know about his kids. I would want him to know what they're into and who they are and who they're becoming and how resilient they've been these last few years, and how their resilience and their joy and their presence in my home has really carried me through. You know, I'd want him to know how amazing they are, and I want to tell him thank you for having those three boys with me, because I couldn't do this without them. I couldn't have done these last few years without my boys. And I'd want him to know that his death wasn't in vain, and that I'm so sorry for his overwhelming pain, and I'm so sorry that suicide felt like the only solution to that pain. And I can't wait to see him again soon.
Well, hopefully not too soon. Your boys, I'm sure, would say, Mom, could you stick around just a little bit longer? You carry this joy and peace in your heart, Kayla, that only God can bring in a situation that you've been placed. And you are carrying a lot of burdens, and that holds a lot of weight. But I know God is walking through this with you. In writing your book, what did God reveal to you that you didn't see during that time and that walk with Andrew?
You know, I think what I've walked through has changed everything. It's expanded the way that I see God. It's expanded way that I do life with God. It's changed my spirituality. It's changed the way that I interact just with the presence of God every day. I think God went from being in this box to being everywhere. And it's like in this new life that I find myself in, God is literally in everything all the time. Like everything is spiritual. Everything is sacred. Everything is beautiful. I read this little book this year. It's called Just This by Richard Rohr. But it talks about seeing that beauty in everything, that we can stare at like a little dandelion and find it to be absolutely overwhelmingly beautiful and see God in it. And so, you know, I think I've just learned to, through all of it, kind of sit back in awe and wonder at the mystery of all of it. That even though during the mental health journey with my husband, God felt very distant and detached. And then after he passed away, it was like God was everywhere. That I can sit back in the awe and mystery of all of that, the mystery of what happened and how it shouldn't have happened, and it did happen, and then the mystery of how even though that happened, life can still be meaningful and beautiful. I couldn't have predicted any of this. I couldn't have mapped out how any of this would have played out. I couldn't even mapped out these last few years and that there would be a book birthed out of this and the lives that would be changed and the stories that would come. And so I really, truly just sit back in the awe and wonder of it all. And, you know, my heart really is full of gratitude. And it's that holding that joy and gratitude and then holding that pain and sorrow. And that's how I'm moving forward every day. It's my son Smith, my oldest son, described it perfectly. He had this Mother's Day makeover at his school, the very first Mother's Day after Andrew had passed away. And it's super cute. The kids do like makeup on their moms and they wrote us these cute little letters. And you know, for Mother's Day, oftentimes they have those fill in the blanks. Like, my mom's favorite food is this. And I love it when my mom wears this and her favorite store is this. And so one of those fill in the blanks, my son wrote, "I love it when my mom takes me to the cemetery and takes me to Disneyland, literally the saddest place on earth and the happiest place on earth in the same sentence." And so that's our life. That's a perspective. You know, it's one foot in the saddest place on earth and the other foot in the happiest place on earth. And it's moving forward one step, one day at a time.
Amen. Oh, beautiful, Kayla. Well, I know people are going to want to connect with you. Where can they find you?
Yeah, Instagram is the best place. My Instagram handle is Kayla Steck.
Okay. We will make sure we have all that information in the show notes. And also, you all are going to want to pick up your own copy of Fear Gone Wild, A Story of Mental Illness, Suicide, and Hope Through Loss. Well, before I let you go, I have one last question. The series is called My Strength is My Story. What has your story gifted you?
You know, I think that resonates a lot with me. I think I'm a lot stronger than I thought I was. Maybe that's the biggest takeaway, is that I am a completely different person than I was before Andrew died, and that I'm a lot stronger than I thought I was.
Oh, that is beautiful. Well, I know Andrew is looking down right now, and he has a smile on his face. And I know in your book, you write about, let me see if I can actually find the last of it. I think it's at the very end. It says, "Good job, babe. I'm so proud of you. Look how far you've come." Kayla, as you can tell, it's touched me. And I know it's touched many people. Thank you so much for your time, for your energy, for your love, and for your grace. Many blessings as you continue your journey and you share your story.
Thank you so much.
Feeling inspired, ready to train for life, and love your journey? Visit createyournow.com for more incredible resources to help you along the way. We'll see you next time on Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. And remember, always be sure you consult your physician before beginning any health and fitness plan.